Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Hannah. I am delighted to have you today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have been swapping messages, and you've introduced me to some of your friends and colleagues on the West Coast to participate in some of our panels and other conversations here on the podcast. I'm like, well, I want to get Hannah on here. I want to hear your thoughts about this shared profession that we have. So I'm delighted that we were able to coordinate some time today to catch up. Before we dive into whatever it is your big idea, bold opinion might be, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thank you so much, Jason, for having me. Super excited that we finally found a time to make this work. My name is Hannah Berger. I am a fundraising professional with nearly 20 years in the sector, which is like, how did I get this old? I am based in Los Angeles, and I'm a full-time practitioner. I work for an incredible, transformative community youth center in South Central Los Angeles called A Place Called Home. There, I'm the senior director of individual giving and communications. And I also have a coaching and consulting practice where I focus on nonprofit executives. I work with them on management and fundraising skills. And I also work on special major campaigns. That's kind of my sweet spot.
So Hannah, you've been around long enough to have an opinion about sort of where fundraising finds itself. Where do you think in the midst of, you know, in the nonprofit sector, oftentimes we're sort of shoved off in sort of the corner and expected to do our job. And sometimes we posture ourselves like a sort of an awkward stepchild or something. Where do you think we find ourselves? And perhaps where do you think in the midst of everything, you and I are sitting, for the sake of our listeners, you and I are sitting here on the having this conversation on the third day of the impeachment trials of Donald Trump. And you know, we know what we've all been through in the last 12 months as a country and a society. Where do you think we fit in this?
That's everything I wanted to talk about today.
I'm sure you did. we're gonna unravel that, but just give me like 2 minutes, yeah. And then we'll let you tee it up a little better.
Well, you know, my perspective has shifted dramatically in the last year, and that's okay. Because, you know, I kind of came up in this old school mentality.
Yeah.
Like, great fundraisers are people that make other people with wealth feel great. Right. That's your job.
Just kiss their ass, right?
To find the money, make them feel like a god.
Right,
and,
right.
And get them to invest in your worthy mission, right?
Right.
And so not only, you know, I reference my coaching and consulting practice, but I also teach and train a lot with other partners.
Yeah.
Organizations and universities, et cetera. And the way I've been teaching my students has shifted dramatically because, you know, the way I see it, fundraisers, we have this incredible access to both sides of the equation, right? We're frequently that go-between where we are attracting wealth into organizations that need resources to serve a disenfranchised community for the most part, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And with that should be this incredible sense of responsibility around, you know, maybe it's not that I'm supposed to make them feel great. Maybe it's that I'm supposed to help educate and elevate marginalized voices and ensure that the people that we're attracting to invest are partners. And that while there is this inherent commitment to believing that there's good intentions, there's also this awesome opportunity to open eyes and share new ideas and really kind of push challenging conversations about why we have this incredible need for philanthropy in the United States.
Have you, Hannah, and again, I want to sort of follow the direction of where you want to go with this today, but have you sort of, because this is something I've been sort of contemplating probably throughout my career, and I'm sure you have in many ways too, but I've never sort of been able to frame it up as much as I have, perhaps like you have in the last 12 months. But I've always sort of thought we were trying to sort of professionalize what I would consider a very passive role, right? So we want to sort of elevate ourselves, but we don't want to take an assertive or active role in sort of negotiating where the money flows, for example. So regardless of whose payroll we happen to be on, regardless of who's necessarily writing the check, as long as we professionalize the transaction or the exchange of those resources, then we can all pat ourselves on the back, go home and feel like we did our job. But I think the realization I'm coming to, and again, I haven't articulated this in writing or anything, but I think I've always, I remember saying to one of my professors in graduate school, why aren't we the ones, rather than wanting to be the ones invited to the party, why aren't we the ones hosting the party, I guess you could say. And what I was referring to is the nonprofit sector in general, you know, rather than always sort of, the, you know, it's always the EDs and the fundraising professionals who very enthusiastically want to be invited to the rich guy or the rich gal's party. But maybe we should step it up a little bit and try to be the ones hosting the party. And I mean a real party. I don't mean galas and golf tournaments. I mean, is that sort of what you're wrestling with too?
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're nailing it.
Yeah.
It's really because the people who become fundraisers, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're amazing at building relationships. They're people you want to be around. They have influence.
Yeah.
Right. But I think we've been trained to ignore our power in that.
Yes.
Right. It's almost like you're always secondary. You're always, you know, like very, very, very buttoned up and professional and polished.
Yes.
And you just exist to be like a concierge, you know, like you should make everybody else's day much easier.
Right. And yes.
Yeah,
I love it.
I think that if we take this sort of leadership position around, like, you know, I communicate the message well of the work that we do. I hold the relationships for the organization, and I'm going to exert my influence to encourage a redistribution of power so that we're talking about justice and not charity.
Yeah. And that's a much more active, proactive, assertive sort of role. And it requires a posture that I just don't think that our profession is perhaps there. I mean, I'm oftentimes repeatedly saying to my audience and to my guests that I think fundraising is sort of in the midst of its messy adolescence. And if you think about adolescence, like walking around in middle school and high school, oftentimes we're walking around up and down the hallway, very insecure, sort of propping up, you know, the right tennis shoes or the right, you know, brands on our clothes and stuff. But there's not a lot of real security going on there. Yeah. And then we go to college and we learn a few things and we learn how to think a little bit more critically. And then it's only there when we sort of reach that growth spurt where we actually sort of lean into what our true identity is. And so I don't know that fundraising has sort of reached that place. Hannah, we have really teed this up. We always like to ask our guests to come on with a big idea or bold opinion. So I think we're sort of probably already scratching the surface of it, but that is what we sort of ask our guests to come with. So what is that for us today?
Yeah, I mean, we really already started digging in.
We just opened up the can of worms, didn't we?
Right there. It's fundraisers as leaders and influencers and not just the messengers, but the people that convey the message and recruit and educate and elevate, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of this conduit to like a more equal way of communicating about the biggest injustices that exist. And I really believe that if we start to frame the fundraising profession with under that lens,
yeah,
that we're going to attract more people that should be in this profession, right? So you and I talked in our first exchange about the statistic that exists around the demographics of fundraisers. It's skewed very white. But I also question the statistics, right? Because yeah, I believe that the organizations collecting this data just don't do a great job of recruiting people from our BIPOC communities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all know there are some extraordinarily good fundraisers at our HBCUs and yeah, you know, other institutions that
yeah,
white folks aren't generally working for in a fundraising capacity. So yeah, it's really, you know, I feel like what you said about junior high is like the perfect metaphor for it all, because you're also seeing this like style of fundraiser shifting. Are you familiar with community-centric fundraising out of Seattle?
Yeah, yeah. We've had a number of guests on the podcast talking about that. Yes, yes, very much so.
Yeah. So the way that the folks that are sort of at the forefront that you see, visually see, they're are running that whole operation, their style is very authentic. It's not a navy blazer and a string of pearls, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like everybody's showing up as their full selves.
Yeah.
And that looks a little less quote unquote professional, right?
Yep.
Or what we've been taught is appropriate business attire.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's very exciting for me to watch. And I think a piece of why that's kind of taken off like gangbusters is because of the pandemic, because we're now sitting in front of Zoom all day instead of in boardrooms.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, in a billionaire's living room with their staff present, right? It's a very different scenario, and we've all gotten a lot more casual and more just authentic in the way we're showing up, because we have to.
I'm you and I are running down the same trail, but I had not thought of it. But that's brilliant, Hannah. I had not thought about sort of why I have been thinking about, and a lot of our guests have been talking about, why the pandemic and what role the pandemic is sort of playing in making some of these changes that perhaps would just not budge, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had a guest on here just a couple of weeks ago who was talking about the notion of in the workplace in general, we've known that we could do a lot of what we do at our desks at home virtually. We knew we could do this for 20 years, but we just wouldn't budge, you know, and this is just workplace culture sort of things and the use of technology. But you're exactly right, Hannah. What you're saying is we're not showing up at the office and being constantly reminded that the chairman of the board is a, you know, rich white guy, right? And so we're not constantly being reminded of these power structures that sort of loom over us, and that if we in some way push against them, that's fascinating. You know, Hannah, I think I may have thrown this at you before in some of our exchange on social media, but there's a concept I'd love to get your thoughts on that I think is particularly potent for us in the fundraising sector. Again, I may have thrown this at you, and if I haven't, forgive me, but there's an author at NYU that's talking about this notion of what's called systems justification theory. Okay. Systems justification theory argues that those who are the most negatively affected by the existing system are also the ones who are the most inclined to defend it. And what I have, and understand, he's not, this gentleman is not this guy's not talking about fundraising at all. This gentleman's talking about anybody who sort of sees themselves in a marginalized, overlooked, ignored sort of corner of the world. And I've oftentimes wondered if when we get into these discussions, Hannah, about getting fundraising right and perhaps experiencing this growth spurt, if perhaps those of us who are the most negatively affected by sort of the injustice that's embedded in it are also the most likely to defend it. I mean, here I am, a straight white guy, for example, and I guarantee you there's not many people who are out to totally revolutionize this ship than I am. I mean, but I'm also the guy that the status quo can quite frankly benefit the most, right? The status quo worked for me. I'm pretty much employable. I can get in front of any rich white guy I want to. And so what these folks at NYU are arguing is that it's more likely the sort of the opposite of me who will actually dig in their heels and say, hey, direct mail works. And I'm telling, and people have heard, direct mail doesn't work. Direct mail does not create meaningful relationships. Grant writing, you know, we got Vu and our friends up in Seattle. Vu has very confidently said, you know, if you want to stay marginalized, keep writing grants.
Right.
Yeah. If you don't want to be marginalized, insist on sitting across the ledge table from that fella and tell him what you think. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I hadn't heard that term before.
Systems justification theory. Yeah. Justification. Yeah. I was very much looking forward to our conversation because I knew you'd wrestle with me over it. So, I got it on the table. Now you tell me what you think.
I'm trying to think of real world examples of people where I've had conversations where that is relevant and true. And perhaps I think it might be more of a generational issue. I'm thinking about one woman in particular who I consider a mentor, who I worked with my very first nonprofit out of undergrad in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And, you know, conversations with her as of late, and she's a woman of color. I'm shocked at some of the things that she says about the direction that fundraising is taking. And
Again, we don't want to put somebody on the spot. We're certainly not going to name names, but So are you saying that she's the type of individual? This is what this gentleman at NYU would be arguing. He would say that if she's for example, a woman of color in the fundraising space, that she's going to defend all of these systems that I would traditionally call arm's length fundraising that deliberately distance us from these individuals and therefore don't allow us to insist on. Look, if you want to be proactive, if you want to be assertive in your fundraising efforts, you're going to have to be, quote unquote, sitting across the lunch table with these people. Right. But we rationalize all day long. And is this individual you're referring to? Is she the one who's going to say direct mail really works really well?
No, she's the one. I'll give you a perfect example. I was sharing with her a very similar conversation, some ideas I've had a recent interaction that I had with a class that I was teaching. I taught the same class 3 years ago, obviously a different cohort of adult learners. But 3 years ago, a response I gave to one of my students about, she was a Latinx woman. She was sharing that she feels like when she shows up at work, she can't be her full self. 3 years ago, right? Let's rewind.
Yeah.
And my advice to her then makes me full of shame now, right? My advice to her then was basically, we all have to do it. You know, it's part of the game in fundraising.
Yeah.
Like, I don't love wearing a navy blazer, but I do it when I'm going out to meet the rich white guy who doesn't take me seriously because I'm a woman.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing. And that fills me with shame now that I think about that. And I was sharing with my mentor that I got a very similar, you know, vulnerable moment from a student in class. And my response now was, you should feel supported in showing up as your full authentic self.
Yeah.
And if you don't feel that way at your place of business, you should ask yourself if it's the right place for you to spend your time and talents. Because you are talented, You are driving incredible revenue and value to the organization you serve, and others will allow you to show up as your full self. And my mentor said to me, "Oh, honey, like, that's really sweet, but, you know, it's you and I both know that if you want to get in front of the wealthiest people, you just have to do what they want."
Yeah, you have to. Your mentor was telling you got to play the game, and what systems justification theory would tell you is that those people like myself, I don't want to play the game at all. And I would say that everything that has sort of created opportunity for me in the last, especially in the last 5 years, is because I won't play by the rules. I won't play the game. And I think if I'm sort of reading between the lines in your sort of reaction and your response and your dialogue with this person you're mentoring in Washington, is that you're saying, and perhaps what we're realizing in the last 12 months is look, the game's over.
That's what I'm saying. I think that her perspective is the game is not over. It won't be soon.
Right. Exactly.
And the fact that you think it's over is a privileged perspective.
Yes. Well, and that's what he would say. That's what his name escapes me. But he would say that the privileged individuals in our society generally feel like they get to call the shots on the game, if you will.
Right.
But they're also the ones that when they feel like the game is up, will quit playing the game.
Right.
And in our line of work, I think we've been playing the game so long. You know, I think we've been playing what I call arm's length fundraising so long, content to become professionals at galas and golf tournaments and direct response and facilitating relationships that are, quite frankly, quite shallow, that you're never going to get to the lunch table with that rich guy or that rich gal,
right?
And never be able to assert yourself.
Yeah, agreed. Can I ask you a question?
Oh yeah, you can chat. Yeah, push back.
So another thing that I wrestle with all the time is, you know, I am Caucasian and I want to be the best possible ally that I can be.
Yeah.
But I also want to make sure that when there's an opportunity to elevate the voice of somebody who's been marginalized, that I make sure that happens, right? So I'm always oscillating between when do I use my voice to speak up and really speak directly to white folks about this whole problem?
Yeah.
And when do I make sure that somebody who's not being heard is getting heard, right?
Yeah.
So an opportunity like this per se, right? So you being a straight white man,
yeah,
I feel like if we could just recruit a bunch of Jasons to get out there and start talking directly to, like, we would have an easier time getting in front of most of the, you know, seven-figure donors that I've worked with over the years than I would, because most of them are straight white men.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean? So I'm wondering about, like, how do you plan to exert your power and influence?
So we have these road shows. I'll share with you two sort of anecdotal sort of experiences, stories for the last several years. So 10 or 12 years ago, I went to work for the Epilepsy Foundation in Washington. Mm. And my boss was an African-American woman. Her name's Danielle. And I got to say, she probably opened up the door for me to figure out this fundraising stuff more than anybody else. But I also really enjoyed working with her. And she and I would travel together. We'd go around the country. And the dynamic of her being a single Black woman and me being a married white guy, her being about 10 years. So there was a lot of contrast between our world experience, you know, our lived experiences, if you will. Yeah. And yet we really enjoyed, it was really enjoyable work, you know, getting on. But the other thing we did is on a number of occasions, we'd be in places, you know, we'd be in Boston, we'd be in New York, we'd be out in Denver somewhere, you know, we're interacting with these very super wealthy white people. Often, you know, they look more like me and their lived experience is oftentimes more so aligned with mine than perhaps hers. But I mean, I think it was And then I'll parallel this with my other sort of story. When we do our road shows, Hannah, if there's an African-American woman in the room, for example, who is in a, what I call an arm's length fundraising job, and I can compel her in any way to have the confidence to interview for what we traditionally call a major gifts role, mm-hmm. I'm speaking to her the whole damn time. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's 35 people in the room, and I'm, and as soon as I spot her, I'm like, if you want to revolutionize fundraising, we stop, because yeah, that's just sort of, that's my reaction to sort of the question. That's just sort of me pulling back the sort of the curtain on what I feel like my role in the current space is. Nice. And I've met them. There's a woman in New York City, for example. She's a great fan of what I do. She reads my books. She listens to podcasts. Showed up for my seminar back in 2019. And she's a remarkably talented, eloquent major gift officer, African-American woman. And if we want to get to the place like you and I are sort of envisioning here, here's a messy thing to wrestle with, and it would be really helpful. And all my guests are going, anybody who's listening is going to agree. I think in some ways people who've lived much more challenging lived experiences than perhaps I have, or even perhaps you have, are actually in some ways much better at this work to begin with. Right.
I think that people that have, yeah. I mean, I think the people that have had more challenging lives, period, are better at everything, quite frankly. Right. There's this resiliency factor.
Yeah. Right? Right.
It's like it's a muscle that some people don't ever have the opportunity to develop.
Yeah.
But so I work full time for a place called Home, Youth Community Center in South Central. Essentially, we exist to make sure that the kids growing up in one of the most impoverished zip codes in the country get every opportunity, support, exposure, access that the wealthiest kids on the west side of LA get, right?
Yeah.
As the director of communications, one of my favorite things is that I get to talk directly with our members and our alumni about their story. And every single one of those kids are brilliant. They are successful. They, at a very young age are so much, like, we had a young woman who's a junior in high school attend our executive team meeting this week to pitch us on a new club idea, a Gay Straight Alliance.
Yeah, sure.
And her presentation skills at 16 blew my mind.
Yeah.
And in large part, that's because of the work we do at a place called Home. But it's very little about the organization as much as it is just about kind of giving them the exposure and just a little bit of support and resource and a tiny bit of training, right? But because they are growing up in an environment that is challenging, like, make no mistake about it, poverty and the symptoms and the, all of the effects of systemic poverty is just, it's a hard way for any human being to grow up. But because that resiliency factor that they're gaining living in that community, paired with a little bit of exposure and opportunity, makes for magical human beings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and when I meet adults who I find extraordinary, 10 times out of 10, they've got a backstory that has pain in it.
So go back to the, I've been up on my soapbox enough here. Go back to the individual in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So where do you want her to be in 5 years? And what's standing in her way right now?
The woman in D.C. is a mentor of mine.
Oh, this is a mentor of yours. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. If you were mentoring her, tell me where you think this person ought to be in 5 years.
Well, she's retired.
Given your sort of read on where the world is right now.
Oh, I mean, I pray that in 5 years, she is just baffled and delighted at how different things are, right?
So you want her to be convinced that the rules that she's trying to play by?
I want her to feel like, as a woman of color,
yeah,
that she is living in a world that feels like it's actually more equal than it did 5, 10, 20 years ago, right? I want her to feel like things that she perceived to be impossible are possible.
And are you suggesting where we were a few minutes ago, perhaps before I got on one of my tangents, I don't know. But is it perhaps that you think is perhaps some of the challenges that you might see differently between you and her or somebody younger than the two of us, for example, you were maybe suggesting that it's generational. I had two women here on the podcast that were broadcast about 2 weeks earlier than this episode that you and I, and these are two women that are very much engaged in the conversations with Vu and our friends up at in the CCF community. Yeah. They're both women. One's a African, one's a white woman like myself, and one's an African American woman. And I got to tell you, I don't think they're going to be wrestling with the same challenges 10 years, down the road that perhaps you and I are, or that perhaps our predecessors, our mentors necessarily are right now. And the resources that maybe are there, may not have dramatically changed. The money still may be in the hands of a lot of white people, but I think a lot of perspectives will have changed. What do you think about that?
I mean, I feel like they already are. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of glimmers of hope, but there's also, a lot of my current funder relationships at a place called home. Not a lot, a few. There's a lot of conversation in philanthropy right now about the way that foundations do business.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and lots of it.
The standards that they hold the nonprofit partners to is really not like a partnership, that it's actually very like colonial in nature, right?
Yeah,
lots of
hoops
to jump through, lots of reporting to be done. The kind of work that only organizations with a lot of staff can take on, right? So then smaller groups that are doing incredible work and communities that need it, they get overlooked. And, we have a few of those partners, and that's frustrating. And that, I think, will take a lot longer to dismantle, because the people that are on those boards are all looking through the same lens. And so, I did a session last night for a women's networking group about nonprofit board service.
Yeah.
And the message I was preaching, in addition to do this, please, because we need more diverse female leaders on boards for nonprofits, was, white folks, we have to take on the role as disruptor. If you believe this message, it's time to stop talking about it and start pushing for action.
Yeah.
Because we're starting to see that happen, right? At the highest, I don't want to say the highest levels, but the largest foundations in the country, they appear to be taking steps in that direction of adding more diverse folks to the mix, of taking on new policies that are a little bit more lenient and accessible. But I don't know, I'm a little apprehensive about how quickly we can move the needle on that. So I think like my sweet spot is individual philanthropy, major donors. And I feel like one-on-one with people, we can make quick work of this conversation.
Right.
If we have the conversation.
One of the things I talked to about these two women who were on the podcast, for my sake of my listeners, it's a broadcast that broadcast about 2 weeks prior to this one. Hannah, I'm just not convinced that it's the donors who are all that problematic in our space. I think it's the storytellers. I think it's the experts in the room, whoever the experts happen to be, that are telling us the story. And that, I oftentimes refer to them as the Wizard of Oz. I think we've got these wizards that are out there telling us how fundraising works. And they tell us all these methodologies, and we become experts at these methodologies. because they can sell us these systems and these processes. And, you know, one author I recently read talks about the sort of the cult of early specialization. You know, if you get your professional identity wrapped up in galas and golf tournaments and direct response and grant writing, you're very likely going to be stuck in that space your entire right. career. That's early specialization. Right. But honestly, you go to any AFP, you know, fundraising conference of any sort, you're going to see a room full of experts selling all of those gadgets and gizmos and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Is it really the donors that are all that problematic?
I mean, the ones with the, you know, biggest capacity, yes,
yeah.
the most problematic.
but are even, okay, so that's fair, but are 90% of the charities in this country even interacting with those super mega donors that you're sort of referring to?
That's a fair point. Yeah,
I mean, I think, you know, I live in York, Pennsylvania. We got 500,000 people in this county. And the quote unquote major donors in this community are, quite frankly, some of the more impressionable people that I've ever met. And I know they'll sit down with pretty much anybody who offers to take them to lunch. These are not people who've got extraordinary wealth of that sort of that uppermost senior sort of echelon. Are they really the problem, or is it the expert around town who's scaring the jajibis out of the development officers and saying these people are not approachable? You're better off writing a grant proposal.
Interesting. So when you say expert, do you mean just
people like you and me?
Okay.
It's the storytellers. It's the people who, it's the people who we privilege with the post at the conferences, the break, the people who are telling the story.
Our keynote speakers.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, perhaps I'm wondering if maybe my bubble is a little too, progressive, you know? So it's kind of like, I'm thinking about social media. The algorithm yeah. gives you more of what you like, right?
Yes.
So I surround
right. Facebook tells you the story you want to hear.
Exactly. So the story that I hear on repeat all the time is, you know, extraordinary leaders look like every shade of the rainbow. We need women yes. to be at the forefront of everything. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's the story I surround myself with. So I presented at the AFP International Conference in 2019. and did a session with a friend of mine about diversifying your board.
Yeah.
And this is another one of those moments where I'm kind of full of shame. The approach that we took in that session was about like kind of ignore the blatant racism when your board members are like, do we really need diversity here?
Right.
Just focus on the most important color, which is green.
Yes. Right.
And I'm being crass, right? That obviously yeah. is not how we pitched this at the workshop, but yeah. So sit on that point right there.
I like to say that in the last several years, anybody who's written a book, I very proudly published a book a couple of years ago. It did really well in this space, and I'm working on a good follow up. But I deliberately chose as a quote unquote, you know, one of those people who gets the privileged post of being recognized at times as an expert. I don't give a damn about who's giving on your board. And I didn't talk about in my book about who's giving on your board. But if you think about where did we get taught that, you know, when you and I were entering into the profession 20 years ago, you and I we sat in fundraising 101 and fundraising 201, you know, we sat in all these breakout sessions and we were told to double down and prioritize whether or not our boards were giving. Hmm. And I got to be honest with you, how many times have you heard, I know I've heard it, and I'm sure my listeners have, how many times have we heard this notion that if your board's not all giving, other people won't? I don't think I've had a major donor in my entire 25-year career actually ask me, in an interrogative sort of way, whether or not all my board members were giving. I don't think they give a damn. I don't think it really comes up all that much.
Interesting.
But the experts, the people who are sort of in the esteemed spots, who've earned several credentials, who get the keynotes and all that stuff, we're the ones telling the story. And maybe the story's not the right story.
You might be right. I mean, you know, I kind of preach that message myself about the board.
Right. Right. Stop worrying about your board, right? Start worrying about it. I know fundraisers I've heard them. They will just sweat bullets over whether or not their board members are all actively giving. And I'm like, you know what? How about you just treat them like donors? You've never caught. Okay. The whole notion of get, you've heard it. Give, what is it? Give, get, or get off.
Yeah.
You would never say that to a donor to begin with.
Never. But so, you know, the way I approach it though, is like, not everybody has to be giving, but everybody has to be getting. I do.
Sure.
Because my board, we're a team. We are a fundraising team, right?
Yeah.
Well, I support them. I train them. I work with them. I do all of the follow up behind them, cleaning things up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's successful.
Yeah.
And that's the way I like to work.
Okay, so but that was that. Isn't that the way you were trained? So you were trained. Somebody told you at some point, just like they taught me, that you, perhaps your board doesn't have to be giving, but they all need to be giving. And what I've always thought is if I want to be a professional fundraiser and I want to be more legitimate in my role, why do I want volunteers necessarily doing the work that perhaps I'm better qualified? And what, how about, and perhaps maybe there's a third of the room that are particular. Some people, Hannah, you can't disagree with this. Some people in terms of getting are just really lousy at getting, right?
Oh, absolutely. But if you can teach them to be really good at it, it's so empowering. And, and let's be real.
Yeah.
It would probably outlast a lot of not like, okay. The average tenure of a director of development is what, 18 months?
Yeah. 18, 24 months. Right.
So if you can successfully teach other people to do what you do.
Yeah.
Then when you move on, if you move on, that skill stays with the organization and supports the mission. That's the way I approach it. So you're right. I agree. The whole like old adage about like give, get, or get off is garbage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we also need the people in a leadership position to, you know, really value resource development. And it's got to be something that's forefront of mind and something that they support and invest in.
And
maybe not personally, but as a collective body, they're willing to say, okay, we're going to spend a little bit more to make more resources that we need available to us to fulfill mission.
Yeah. So some of the more recent, and I think this is coming from VU and our community centered fundraising friends, that the idea of credentialing and professionalization and such is perhaps some of what has created problems for us, and part of what we need to really don't we need to be aware that the elitism and the sort of the privilege and the access that oftentimes follows, or the debates over these things that follows credentialing and licensing and so forth and professionalization, I'm hinging on a word you used a moment ago, very simply put, can't fundraising just see itself as a skill?
As opposed to a profession? Or you're saying?
I'm saying are the storytellers that step on the platform and tell us that fundraising has to be a professional license, for example. The storytellers are telling us that the best way to do this is for it to be to not just be a skill that we can teach board members, that we can teach your executive director, that we can teach, that my colleague and I at the Epilepsy Foundation can learn together, that you and I can sort of, you know, develop the skill of fundraising for the benefit of a program director, for example, but is perhaps some of what the storytellers have for too long been telling us is that it has to be a professional sport.
Interesting. I guess when you, yeah, because that's the difference between sort of a infinite versus a fixed mindset, right?
I mean, what I do with my clients is I oftentimes am teaching executives, oftentimes educational leaders, heads of schools, presidents, and those, you know, people who are in a position of seniority in a nonprofit organization. I essentially teach them the skill of fundraising, but I don't think that they have to earn the CFRE to necessarily raise $1 million.
Oh, agreed. I know that by experience.
Right. Yeah. But do we have to tell, but you and I have learned that because we've been around, we've learned that by the School of Hard Knocks. We've been around for 20 years and we know that, but perhaps people like you and I, if we could become better storytellers so that people 2 and 3 years in, okay, you give me a lot of time to talk, but I got to pour more out of you.
Yeah, I mean, you make an exception. Such a good point. I've been doing, you know, and right there with you, I've been doing a ton of reflection about how I show up and talk about our profession and how I frame things for the students that I teach. And,
right,
you know, the way I speak, not only about the profession of fundraising, but about the community that we serve and, you know, removing the donor as the center of all communication, which is something I was taught from day one.
Yes.
You know, it's like the quicker you draw the line between the donor being the savior, the better. And that's, I think that's very much to our detriment. So I'm being really conscious about that.
Have you ever met a donor? Have you ever met a donor that actually wanted to hear that you were doing quote unquote donor centered fundraising, that you were putting them at the center of everything?
Have I ever met a donor that wanted that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Tell me about who is that donor?
I'm not going to name them.
Right. I don't mean that. But I mean, who is that? Because I honestly have spent my entire career interacting with individuals of all shapes and sizes from all different sort of corners of the world in different places and representing a number of different causes. And I just don't think that the person writing a $25,000 check, for example, to the Epilepsy Foundation was all that interested in me putting her at the center.
Oh, I see.
Of much of anything. Because she knew, for example, a $25,000 donor to the Epilepsy Foundation more than likely has a son or a daughter who suffers from a seizure disorder.
Right.
And if anything, she wants the organization to be all about, she could really care less whether you make the whole organization or the whole fundraising operation around her, because she's really just interested in you contributing to research that finds a fix for her son or daughter.
Right. Right. Yeah. So the donor I'm referring to, I'll give you a quick like persona.
Yeah.
They are a white man over the age of 65.
Yeah.
Who is semi-retired, is a not quite a billionaire, but pretty darn close. does their philanthropy in 3 cities around the country.
Sure.
And really, 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 really loves naming opportunities.
Yeah.
And likes to write checks in 7 and 8 figure increments. That's who I'm talking about.
Okay. So can I get on another bandwagon with you?
Yeah.
Are they basically consumers? If they're basically buying the name on the side of a building, right? The story I think that we've been told in fundraising. I'm testing all my ideas with this new book with you, Hannah, and I feel bad, but this is a good. I hope this is a valuable conversation. I think we have spent. That's also a baby boomer, and I think the baby boomers have basically lived their entire life as consumers and nothing, pretty much nothing else. They've lived their life as consumers. And fundraising, if you think about it, with its history and sort of get, you know, in PR and marketing and advertising and so forth, you're selling him a name on a side of building no differently than you're selling a donor, you know, on NPR a tote bag, right? You're just selling them stuff. And perhaps if we start thinking about these people, we get told by the storytellers that gentleman wants to be sold something.
That's true. That's true. So how do we unravel this, Jason?
I think people like you and I need to get on the road and get 25 people in a room. I don't know. I mean, I feel like my contribution is facilitating I have a sponsor who allows me to sort of spend my time provoking meaningful conversations like this a couple of times a week. And I've got students over at the college that I talk about these things with. But I think some of the challenge is that we've got to get there's got to be a bolder. I take it back, Hannah, forgive me, but I take it back to the systems justification stuff. Privileged white guys are confident propping up podcasts and asking bold questions.
It's good. Well, you know, there's the flip side of this is being bold about the way that we message and working with these impact donors in a way that is totally mission focused and not about feeding their egocentric needs also requires a willingness on the part of the organization's board, executive director, CEO, whomever, to walk away from a potentially lucrative scenario, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's still really where the hiccup is occurring. I know that some of the clients I work with, they really struggle with that because they feel like they're making headway and then the donor's like, well, I'm going to change. I want these stipulations about the program that I'm going to fund for you because I think it's the right move, even though I know nothing about the work that you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And the CEO or, you know, board chair, whomever will say, do it, just do it. They're writing us $1 million check.
Yeah.
And then we're back to square one.
Hannah, I was raised in the church. Mm-hmm. I was raised in the church. And a lot of what I have sort of encountered in the last year, as I'm listening to folks like our friends at CCF, for example, is in some ways, you know, the nonprofit sector likes to think that it can be a sort of this secular sort of space of goodwill or, you know, but in some ways, some of the aspirations I think that we have are in many ways just the same aspirations that you would hear in the church. And perhaps do we need to just get okay with that? That we're not necessarily sort of detached from this sort of higher order, you know, whatever that order is, whatever that, you know, power is. Because I think some of what our friends at CCF and others are calling for is a standard that says, a utilitarian ethic that sort of informs, you know, just whatever brings in the most amount of money at the least cost really isn't just the ethical way to do it.
Right.
But when you change your ethic, when you change the construction of whatever your ethical sort of way of life is, ultimately the direction I feel like we're going is very similar to what I would have learned in the church. In a faith tradition.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or that like there's, we are all
just like there's a higher standard, that there is a higher standard for which you, it's not just whether or not you raise the most amount of money. It really does matter where that money comes from. It really does matter how you went about getting that money, but just raising a lot of money, which tends to be the metric that a lot of us are being evaluated on.
Absolutely.
Which is my concern, and I suspect it would be the same concern that you would have. I had a candidate that was interviewing for a job with a client of mine a couple of years ago. Again, this is an African-American woman. I would have loved to have seen her in that job. But long story short, even the candidate that they ended up going with was out of that job in 2 years because they didn't know how to prop this person up for success to begin with.
Right.
I would have been basically double downing on her. She was better off not getting the job than getting the job. And in some ways, perhaps we need to, you know, when we're talking to young fundraisers, we need to be saying, you know, if your organization doesn't want to raise money a particular way rather than how much they raise, is that where we're getting to?
Meaning they wouldn't be willing to invest in individual philanthropy, like major gifts work, or
I think direct mail is the most shallow, cheap.
Oh, gosh, yeah,
it's the most shallow, and to call it relationship anything is and yet we rationalize it to the nth degree because it quote unquote works. It's very utilitarian. It's pragmatic. It works, But are we getting to the place where we're going to actually say, you know what, it works isn't always necessarily the standard by which something gets evaluated. I feel like the last 12 months, that's what we've been all evaluating, is that it works isn't necessarily the standard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I present to my board of directors at a place called home, I tend to present the analysis in a couple of different ways so that they're really seeing how my time is being spent.
Yeah.
And where the biggest impact is, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, you're opening a can of worms on a whole lot of like ethical dilemmas, right? For instance, you know, when Facebook came under fire this last year, I had not one, not two, but four donors sell a ton of Facebook stock and donate it to us.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, so we just profited off of their investment in a brand that's highly questionable right now in terms of ethics and supporting hate speech, et cetera, right? How do I feel about that? Really mixed emotions, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's that messy complexity that we don't like to mess with in high school and in middle school. We just like somebody to tell us what to do. And this gets back to my argument about the Wizard of Oz standing at the front of the room at the, you know, their keynote address, is that I think in some ways fundraising has been defined by a lot of, in some ways, very authoritarian, sort of very prescriptive, make it feel comfortable, make it feel right. But there's some messy complexity in what we do. And if we're not willing to sort of step back and think a little harder about this,
yeah, I mean, we work with people. That's what we do. And people are messy, you know? But yes, getting back to your point about faith community and the like higher power and purpose and connectedness apps, 100% I'm with you.
Yeah.
I am Jewish.
Yes.
I was raised in the synagogue.
Yes.
I'm surrounded by people of lots of different faiths, and I study their faiths with them. And I am wholeheartedly all about connectedness in my work, in my relationships. I feel like we've gotten to a place where, you know, language and the words we use have never been more important. I find myself looking up definitions constantly these days.
Right.
I want to make sure I'm using the right words.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's getting more acceptable to talk about God and the universe and connectedness in professional settings. And personally, I think that's a really good thing. I think it centers us and grounds us and reminds us that we're all in this together.
Right. And that's what I don't think that like our friends at CCF are doing. If you look at their, and I've looked at their list of sort of, I think it's 10 principles or something. If you look at that in the way that, for example, philosopher Charles Taylor in Canada would look at that, you're moving towards an ethical argument for doing fundraising towards some sort of higher standard. It's not just simply about how much are you raising. And I don't know how many of us who've been in the space as long as you and I have, and certainly those who've been around a lot longer than we have, are ready to sort of live according to that standard. Eventually you just get to a place where you have to say, you know, there's a way to raise money better. That's maybe better. And if it comes at the cost of not raising as much, that's what you got to wrestle with.
I mean, but I believe that this is an abundant world. You know, you and I have probably seen so many examples of that in our long careers, and you might raise less in the short term. But I think if you connect to those 10 principles that CCF preaches, in the long term, you end up exponentially better, right? One thing about their principles that I want to just touch on in this conversation, because I think it's super important, especially when we're talking about the experts and what we're all preaching. One of their principles is all about training fundraisers in anti-racism.
Uh-huh.
And systemic oppression, and just really familiarizing fundraisers with what equity is all about, because that's not a given, right? And I think once we do that, we start educating ourselves in those theories and practices, it's so eye-opening that you can't turn back. And it will fundamentally change the fundraising profession. So.
One final question. Does it really beg the question in some ways? I was bantering with one of our colleagues in this space, who I would say generally takes a more it works utilitarian sort of argument. But does a lot of what we've been talking about here, Hannah, really, and this is what I talk to about with my students at the college, does it really get back to the question of why the nonprofit sector exists to begin with? Is a lot of this that we're wrestling with not really about fundraising all that much? And it's really about asking ourselves, okay, why does your organization exist? And why does the sector as a whole exist? Because I think a lot of the assumptions about the way that this should work, we've adopted because, you know, efficiency, for example, as a standard, efficiency, predictability, and control as a standard comes from the private sector. Comes from the way that Walmart and Amazon and McDonald's sells us cheap, right? Maybe efficiency, predictability, and control really isn't the metrics by which we want to. When I look at the CCF sort of list, I say, okay, basically, in order for me to deliver on these 10 things, efficiency, predictability, and control are basically out the window.
Right.
But I can learn to develop new metrics, new standards, new ways of sort of evaluating what it is I'm doing, and consequently probably deliver on something that's more true to what the nonprofit sector and what our organization and perhaps what we expect of our donors.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. The nonprofit sector exists to address systemic inequalities. That's it, right? You know, I always say to my clients, like, if your vision isn't to put yourself out of business someday, you're not doing this right.
Right. Yeah. See, there you go. See, okay. So Walmart, Amazon, and Target are not in the business of putting themselves out of business. That's a fundamentally different way. And that's what I say to my students at the college. I'm like, look, if you exist, if you think you're going to go work in a nonprofit organization just to keep, you know, just to line your pockets and have a successful career, that's really not, this is the sector for you. But I think some of the standard donor-centered fundraising, that's, again, this is sort of the tension that's a lot of being talked about. Here we are an hour into this conversation. I'm not willing to hang it up yet. The CCF folks are pushing against donor-centered fundraising. Donor-centered fundraising is just a borrowed from consumer-centered market. It's just consumer language.
Absolutely.
All they're doing is they're just hijacking language from the consumer that Walmart and Target would use. At least what CCF is doing is saying, let's wrestle with some ideas that are sort of uniquely ours, and maybe align them with some ideas that were sort of uniquely ours to begin with. We don't have to borrow everything that Walmart and Target comes up with.
I mean, can you imagine? Right? Like, yeah, I'm very guilty. I've taught a lot of those concepts. I'd spent 5 of my almost 20 years in corporate philanthropy and walked out of that experience like, I got this all figured out. I'm just going to teach everything I just learned and we're going to keep doing it that way. Nope, that's not the answer. However, very valuable experience because you end up speaking their language, right? Which is beyond valuable in terms of soliciting corporate partners in the future. Yeah, it's kind of a radical approach, but good God, I think we can, if enough leaders are speaking loud enough, we can make quick work of this. What I'm really fascinated to see is how are our professional associations going to evolve? Like AFP, you know?
I don't know if they can. But one of my colleagues, when my book came out in 2018, you know, we distributed 450 copies or something of that book at the ICON conference, for example. And one of the things that my colleague who accompanied me on that particular trip noticed is that basically the conference hall was filled with technology companies. That's really the driver behind all that. But I think some of this loops back to sort of some of your observations when we started. I think a lot of those, I don't know that they're wrestling with the ethical questions like you and I are and CCF is and so forth. I think they're wrestling with the fact that someone like yourself or myself can prop up a podcast and have an extraordinary audience in a matter of 20 minutes. I think that's the question question that Henry Timms and Hyman's in their new book, the folks that organized Giving Tuesday, that's what they're wrestling with. Because they're referring to what they call new power. New power is the ability for an individual like myself propping up a podcast and having an audience that's far bigger than what AFP can organize in New Orleans next year. Right. And that's what I want to say. Going back to, I think, your question earlier, that's what I want to say to that, like those two young women that were on my podcast a couple of weeks ago. And I think they're figuring this out. They're far brighter than even maybe you and I are. They know that they can prop that up. And so that's, I think, what the, you know, to the question of what's AFP wrestling with. The power, the dynamics of how of organizing people is essentially fundamentally changed.
Indeed. And speaking of those technology companies that sponsor the big conferences, they've kind of changed the game about, you know, crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. That revenue stream didn't exist a decade ago. 15 years ago. Right.
Yeah.
And now it's a way to, you can in fact walk away from your seven-figure donor if they aren't values aligned with you, and replace that money with 1,000 people that you touch.
Sure, you can. Media, yes. Right.
It's totally possible and feasible.
Yes. Yes.
It's changed the game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
a dynamic shift. That's an interesting conversation, the power dynamic shift that's been inevitable and how it's all going to play out, right?
Yeah, so Henry Timms, so for my listeners, I'll put a link in the show. So Henry Timms and his and Jeffrey Hyman's wrote a book called New Power. And a lot of what he talks about is the realization, for example, a lot of us were watching as President Trump in 2016 told us he was going to build a wall, you know, between us and Mexico. And what Timms is talking about, and because he's reading other authors and he's becoming much more attuned to sort of this realization that the nonprofit sector, just like every other sector, needs to be aware of, our risks are not physical risks anymore. So building walls between us and Mexico really isn't what is a quote unquote risk. You know, you're not protecting us from, you know, the warring Mexicans or whatever the hell Trump was trying to argue. The risks are embedded in these systems like this platform we're on and face, you know, the Facebook stuff that we were talking about with those are the risks. And so Timms is talking about the idea that until organizations like AFP and large associations come to the realization that they're not building walls anymore, that the opportunity is in digital spaces like this, they're probably fighting the wrong fight.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Could we keep going? We probably could, huh?
We probably could. Maybe we should do a part two.
I have had your attention. I've kept you. You've given me you've given me several very patient moments to get up on my soapbox. Hannah, I'd love to have you back. And I will welcome the opportunity to continue this conversation on or off the podcast. If somebody's interested in following up with you, perhaps they want to commend you for very patiently sitting here with me for an hour. how would you suggest that they reach out to you?
Yeah. I'm on LinkedIn, Hannah, H-A-N-N-A-H, Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, or my website is thephilanthropycoach.com.
Hannah, it has certainly been a pleasure. Am I pronouncing, is it Hannah or Hanna? Did I pronounce that wrong the whole time? Hanna, I apologize.
Okay. I deal with it every day.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. It has certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.